We start today's program with K-12 education in Arizona, as many districts in the state have started the school year or are about to. Earlier this week, State Schools Superintendent John Hoopenthal said a lot of schools have made huge strides, and it's time for the legislature to provide more funds.
The message we are taking forward is that an investment, another dollar in education, unlike many other states, another dollar in education, we're going to give you $10 worth of value. That's our message that we're bringing out there.
Hoopenthal also said 20% of schools in the state have improved their academic performance over the last year. Another 63% maintained their grades in Arizona's A2F system. So how much more needs to be done? Where can the greatest progress be made? I'm joined by Dale Frost, Director of Education Innovation for the Brewer Administration. Dale, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's briefly get your reaction to the A through F grades that came out this week. What should we interpret from that?
So one of the headlines has been that proficiency rates haven't gone up, but the number of A and B schools have gone up. One of the reasons why has been that not only are we measuring how many students are passing, but we're looking at improvement. And so students are improving, they're moving forward, but there are some discussions that need to be made as we move to a new assessment about what should be the right number of A and B schools. And are we measuring quality? Because the purpose of the A through F grades are to help parents make good choices about where to take their kids in a school choice environment.
Now, you've been involved for the last several years with the administration as far as education policy advising. Mm-hmm. You've been involved in some of the major things that have been taken. In a general sense, what are some things you think Arizona has gotten much better at, and what are some areas that are still a challenge?
So 2010 was a watershed year for education reform, and a lot of good things that are still that our school system is still working on implementing that over time will help kids across the board. First, we made it clear that we're going to be expecting kids to read by third grade. So starting this last year, those who scored in the bottom category on AIMS, who showed that they clearly couldn't read, are going to be retained and provide extra support so that they're not falling further and further behind as they move forward. A few years after that, Governor Brewer championed $40 million extra in the budget to help target interventions for these kids so that they can, so they're not held back, that they're reading by third grade. Another important one is that we raised our standards, and Arizona's College and Career Ready standards have been controversial. And I would argue that there's been a fair amount of misinformation about where these came from. The point of these standards were that, let me give you one data point that illustrates this. A student can be functionally illiterate and pass fourth grade reading on AIMS. And we want a state assessment to actually measure. If they're saying you're at grade level, then you are, you know, on track to succeed in post-secondary and in the workforce. And that's the whole point of standardized testing, to give parents a barometer to how their kids are doing. They want that assurance. And it helps administrators and teachers also know if they're on the right track. And AIMS wasn't really doing that. So we raised our standards. AIMS, the last year of AIMS was this last May. And so we're moving towards approving through the State Board of Education a new assessment that holds promise to measure students' ability to think and process and solve problems better. And it will be an online assessment, and it holds a lot of promise that way. So another big innovation in 2010 was we wanted to reinvent teacher and principal evaluations so that not only did they show that they can help students to learn for an hour with the principal in the back of the classroom, but that they receive feedback and they show student improvement through data. And that the schools have been working very hard to get that done. There have been bumps in the road, and we'll still need to work on that system moving forward, but it really is providing feedback that's valuable to teachers and principals.
Dale, do you think Arizona is starting from a lower point than many? Of course, there are always these surveys that say based on per capita spending and also an issue just where the state ranks. Did we start at a lower level, and do you see concrete progress that is understandable to most folks, whether it's parents, teachers, people involved in schools, people who aren't involved in schools?
So most of the rankings that people hear about are based on funding, and we are on the lower end for funding. That is certainly true. One of the reasons why is that we're a growing state, that we have more kids per capita, It's certainly easier when you have more taxpayers to per child to fund at a higher rate, and we're still going to be growing. And so that's going to be a challenge. The governor, through even though we had a budget crisis, she championed Prop 100 to protect education, and it would have been a lot worse had Prop 100 not passed. And she's been championing adding funds into education. We aren't so far back when it comes to outcomes, but we still have a long way to go. One of the great indicators of success is that, you know, thousands more students are graduating from high school now than they were when Governor Brewer came in. But we know that high school graduation isn't enough, that we need to get them, which is one of the things that my office, the Governor's Office of Education Innovation, is looking at. Is so we've gotten more kids to graduation, but not more entering post-secondary. And we know that that is a requirement in the 21st century economy. You don't have to have a four-year degree, but some sort of training to be able to have a living wage, one that you can raise a family on.
And how much of that is even built into the whole competitiveness aspect of it, how where education and business cross, this idea that more businesses are going to want to come here if they're convinced that Arizona's education system is on the way up.
And one of the first things that CEOs ask is not about tax climate or regulatory. It's about how are the schools, because their employees are interested in that. So I think we have one of the things that we have been trying to overcome is a messaging gap, that there are great things happening, that there are excellent schools in Arizona. Some of the best schools in the nation are here. But we do have a challenge that, on average, our students aren't doing as well, and we're moving forward in a number of good ways, but there's still a lot to be done.
Dale, I do have to come back to the funding question, only because there's this battle coming based on a judicial ruling that more than $300 million in the very near future, Arizona's going to have to find a way, presumably based on an appeal. We know that's coming. But if the state is that far behind, how much of a difference? We know that spending doesn't solve problems, but if we talk about the state spending less than it has, do you think, based on some of the innovative ideas you've talked about, will this extra $100, $300 million make a big difference?
We certainly hope it does. This is far from over, and even at the trial court level, it hasn't yet been decided. But if the courts do force the state to pay that money the defendants are looking for, it will be devastating on the state's budget. We'll be back to very much where we were when Governor Brewer took over, which is very concerning. I think the schools have they have a lot of need. So do many other parts of state government, and there's only so much that can go around. So it is very disconcerting. If they do receive those funds, my hope is that we don't repeat what's happened time and again through the decades, which is increases to funding based purely on enrollment and no sizable increase in achievement. Though there have been a lot of mandates passed on schools and a lot of need for those resources. So our hope is that if resources are put in the schools, that they are used wisely and judiciously to move the system forward rather than just doing more of the same.
Dale, very briefly, wanted to ask you a quick question related to standardized testing. Mm-hmm. Just so people understand sort of what's going on now that Ames has gone past, what's the decision-making time frame on this, and what are some of your thoughts on what's to come?
So Ames, May of this last year was the last administration of Ames. That was the last year that high school students were required to pass Ames. 2 years ago, we passed a bill that phased that out. We knew that it would be unfair for students who hadn't yet had a lot of experience under the new standards and not seeing the new test to have that requirement. The State Board of Education is going out through a competitive bidding process right now to select a new assessment. And they are slated to select a new assessment by end of September, early October. So the schools will know what the new assessment will be. And then we will have the administration of that assessment in springtime. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of unanswered questions, though. So A through F letter grades was mentioned, just came out. How the new assessment will be used to calculate A through F letter grades has not yet been decided, and there are challenging transition issues over the next year or so, because, for example, we won't be able to measure improvement because we will only have one administration of a test. Mm-hmm. How do you know how well they would have done if they only have 1 year when they took it? So the state board is wrestling with those questions. What we're trying to do is balance accountability so that great teachers, great leaders, great schools are rewarded, at the same time being fair through that process.
Dale Frost, Director of Education Innovation for the Brewer Administration. Dale, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
For another perspective, I turn now to Andrew Morrill, President of the Arizona Education Association. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What's your reaction initially to the Arizona school grades unveiled this week? What did it tell you?
Well, it's a snapshot in time, as they are every year, because the letter grades still are calculated overwhelmingly on a standardized test score, a single standardized test score. And so we're going to hold true to what we know about standardized test scores. They provide some information. We are probably better advised to be looking at trends. For instance, I think it's positive that we're seeing more third graders in Arizona reading at grade level. Third grade literacy, we know, is a very important benchmark. We're seeing more A schools, and that's good. But I think overall, the message, in contrast to your previous guest, is that schools, educators, and students are succeeding in spite of Arizona's policymakers, not with Arizona's policymakers as a committed partner. When we look at what has happened to funding in this state, I applaud the work of those in our schools because they're getting miraculous results in a failed funding policy.
Andrew, if that funding policy is forced to change, perhaps by this ruling or in other aspects of things, $317 million, where should that money go? How big an impact would it make?
It has a big impact. It should go right back into the formulas that have been gouged over the last 5 years, the gouges that the governor has signed on to with each budget and that the legislative leadership brought to her. We have districts that are funding full-day kindergarten because it's good for students, but at massive costs to their own capacity. They are choosing between, for instance, funding full-day kindergarten and controlling class sizes or compensating their employees fairly. Most teachers in Arizona are paying to be in the profession because they are now earning less than they were in 2008, just as the state is spending less in per-pupil funding than it was in 2008. It would be huge to have that. The legislature and the governor are appealing that court ruling, and I think that's shameful in light of the funding reductions that we've seen happen in the last 5 years.
How closely are you watching what happens with the next governor and how the state's economy does and finds a way to spend more on education in addition, perhaps, to this shortfall that the judge decided on and the Arizona Supreme Court as well?
Well, we're watching very closely because what we've had in the last few years is a wealth of rhetoric and a impoverished funding and strategy system to support that. We are long on goals and outcomes. We need a governor and other leaders elected who will stand with our public school system as a priority. Let's consider this. In a choice-rich state with more public and private choice options than just about any other state in the country, almost 90% of parents who enroll students in our schools in Arizona choose to do so in their neighborhood district public schools. But this choice is not being honored. This choice is barely even being noticed by too many policymakers. So a governor that stood with the number one choice parents make and said our investment needs to follow that choice would be a welcome and refreshing change. And then we need policies that are not punishing, labeling, and dividing school systems, but supporting education so that students are graduating with high standards and ready to succeed, whether they go to college or enter a career immediately.
What are some changes you'd like to see to get kids reading well at a younger age? And another important thing, limiting the number of dropouts, because that's something the Brewer administration has looked into as well.
Early targeting of literacy still remains one of the best strategies and one of the most sound investments. So we've got to focus and continue to focus concentration on third grade literacy, early algebra mastery as early as is reasonably possible, good analytical skills, but also a broad curriculum, which has really been challenged in two ways. overuse of standardized test scores in certain areas mean a loss of other areas of the curriculum. And in particular, when funding cuts have been as drastic as they have been, you have many schools across the state that have been forced to close or greatly curtail their fine arts programs, a lot of their electives, some of their career and technical ed programs that have been cut. And what we know is that a wide-ranging, broad curriculum touches on student interests, introduces them to all kinds of academic areas, and boosts their motivation to do well in school. So those are some things that we need to focus on.
Andrew, finally, I guess I'd like to ask you, what area or areas have you seen the greatest progress? As you mentioned, miracles being performed even with low funding, but get into that a little bit more in terms of steps where you think there have been really nice areas of progress in the past 5 to 10 years even. And what are the biggest challenges beyond funding, which I know is an enormous challenge, but let's, beyond funding, what's the greatest challenge that Arizona educators and the system has to face?
We're educating a very diverse population in Arizona. We have some of the broadest, most diverse fields of students in our 1.1 million students attending public schools. We have a mobile population in many areas of the state. We have a problem with students jumping from district to district or coming in from out of state. So there is a lack of continuity in the education experience that they receive, and yet removing those students, I'm a little cautious to say that our English language proficiency rates are genuine, because I'm concerned about the way we assess that. But we still are moving students through an ELL program best designed at schools. We are trying everything we can at the classroom level and school level to run graduation programs, programs that target at-risk populations of students and keep them mindful of a track that does not end halfway through high school, but continues through high school and anticipates college. So we're seeing a lot of great things happen. Differentiated instruction, which simply means that as a classroom teacher, and I taught high school English for 17 years, I knew how to reach the students in my classroom. I had time to do so. I had a wealth of resources so that if one tactic I was using was not working, I could switch gears and try another approach. Class sizes that are manageable help teachers achieve that kind of differentiated custom, if you will, instruction to students. Mm-hmm. So despite some great odds in the demographics and the impact of the economy on students, let's remember that the economy impacts the families of those students. Mm-hmm. We're still seeing great things happening in our public schools.
Andrew Morrill is president of the Arizona Education Association. Andrew, thank you for the time today.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the Valley's housing market and what could the merger of Zillow and Trulia, what kind of effect could that have on realtors in the Valley? Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Mary Kay Homes, presenting the Arizona Living Collection at 15 communities throughout the Valley, with move-in-ready homes available now or with flex design to customize your house. MaryKayHomes.com.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. Sunny skies across most of the state right now. It's 73 degrees in Flagstaff, 97 in Casa Grande. It's 93 degrees in Tucson and 100 right now in Yuma. You can expect some delays on the I-17 northbound at Indian School right now. A truck has spilled part of its load of tile onto the roadway. DPS is helping to clean up that situation. Get classic jazz whenever you want it at jazz.kjzz.org and on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. Sunny skies right now in Phoenix, and it's 99 degrees at 11:26.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. In my neighborhood, several for sale signs have gone up recently in front of houses. How soon will they be bought? Who's even looking right now? In his latest report, Mike Orr, director of the Center for Real Estate Theory and Practice at ASU's W.P. Carey School, says the Valley's residential market is in the midst of an 11-month slump in demand. And Mike Orr joins me now in studio. So, Mike, how do we define this as a slump? Why is this a slump?
It's a slump in demand because sales are lower than they've been last year, and there's all sorts of signs of, you know, lack of enthusiasm amongst buyers at the moment.
So what are some of the conditions that those of us who are lay people should be looking at?
Well, it's not a desperately unusual situation, but the big change from last year is we had a lot of demand up until July from investors. In fact, it was unusually high, and then suddenly, when it got to the summer, the investors all lost enthusiasm. Many of them moved elsewhere. And I suppose a lot of that's good news because we don't have so much distressed property that's been through foreclosure or short sales. And that's this lack of supply of distressed homes has put those buyers off. They're looking for bargains. 25% below market value is their target. If they can't find them, they'll go elsewhere. And with the investors gone, the rest of us haven't really amounted to enough to make up for the gap, particularly the first-time home buyer. You know, it's pretty tough to be a millennial. The economy's been pretty poor throughout their sort of working life. They're, many of them not in the career they thought they wanted to be in. Some of them have big student debt to pay off still. And at the same time, the lenders have got fairly strict rules about underwriting, much stricter than they were 10 years ago. So they're worried that even if they did try and buy a house, they would fall at one of the hurdles when trying to get approved for a loan. So many of them not even applying. And the ones that do apply, you know, not all of them get through to that last hurdle and get approved for a loan. So rentals are really hot and home buying is pretty cold.
Now, we were looking at a system when things really took off. I mean, things were seemingly overpriced and many people were getting into homes that perhaps they couldn't afford, in many cases definitely couldn't afford. Do you see us going back to and getting back to the strength of what the system was before the big explosion? Right? Can we get back there and how soon?
I think everybody would like it to get back to normal and calm, and you know, those people who can afford a loan can get one, and those people who shouldn't don't get one. And we've been through pretty much every extreme. At the moment, most people would like it to be a little bit more active than it currently is. It's not great for business if homes are not selling quickly. All the people who are in the real estate business are not getting as many transactions as they'd really like to process. We're about 16% lower this year than we were last year, year-to-date sales. That's quite a significant drop.
That is a significant drop. So, I mean, is there something more to be read into that? Is this, when we look at the unemployment numbers, I know people like to look at certain aspects of it. When I see it these days, I think, how is that going to affect the housing market?
Well, the first thing that you can see is that with the overall demand for housing, whether they're purchased or rented, is down because people are sharing more. In particular, young people are sharing with their parents. You know, they're putting off that moment where, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when I grew up, people couldn't wait to get out of their parents' house. Now it's unusual. People will stay until even 30 before they've set up on their own. So that reduces the demand for housing. And then when they do move, sometimes they're renting a home and sharing with all their friends. And you can get, you know, a lot of people into a single family home if there's no kids involved. What I think is when people start creating families, when the birth rate starts to recover, then there will be more household formation. And that's what I'm really looking for. We did see some signs of progress there with the Census Bureau. They just recently reported for April, March, and June that the household formation numbers had started to increase again. They've been very low for the last year or so. Those are national figures, but I think it would apply here. And gradually we'll get more of that sort of 20 to 30 generation deciding to set up home on their own. Initially, that will create rental demand, but eventually that will also create demand for more homes to purchase.
So I'm glad you brought that up because I think there are some cynics, and maybe they're right, that younger generations, whether just because of lifestyle or because of what they saw with the recession, don't necessarily see buying the home as the so-called American dream. Are you seeing some of that or is that overblown?
I think that's generally right. Of course, you can't generalize to, you know, not everybody who's 20 to 30 thinks the same. And I've met some who are, you know, only 25, 27, and they're already experienced real estate investors. They really believe in real estate. But the average 20 to 30-year-old has been through a time where owning a home was not necessarily a great thing. If you bought between 2004 and 2008, you probably ended up underwater, even now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a much scarier idea than it was back in 2002. And at that point, everybody who'd bought a home was feeling really pleased with themselves. So I think actually it's unlikely that we're going to see that same sort of bubble explosion in my lifetime again. That's a, you know, once in a century or maybe twice a century event. So it's really relatively safe, but confidence has to be built up slowly over time.
What time of year is usually the strongest for the Valley housing market?
March to June are usually the peak months. Okay. It varies from year to year which one is the strongest, but by the time we get to July, everyone wants to be ready for kids going back to school. So those people with children move out of the market then, and it's left to retirees or singles and childless couples. They're the ones who are shopping now.
What sort of a sign, anecdotally, should people look for if they see new homes popping up or new developments popping up? What are you seeing in terms of that, and what does that tell us about the greater market?
Well, new home subdivisions are popping up all the time, but at the same time, existing ones sell out and close down. So that, you know, you can't really tell. Just because one opens up next to you doesn't mean the market's changed.
Yeah.
You actually have to survey the whole area and see how many have we got. There's about 400 subdivisions active at any time, and that's up from a couple of years ago when we got close to 300. But it's nothing like 900 or 1,000 that we had going back in, say, 2004.
I guess, Mike, to close this on an up note, because people could always use good news,
yeah.
What makes you optimistic? Could the fall season be good as we get more people coming back?
I think this year is going to be a bit of a dud.
Okay.
I'm not terribly optimistic things are going to be change dramatically over the next 6 months, but I think next year will be an improvement over this one. Lenders must be frustrated they're not doing enough loans, and the future's in their hand. If they start telling their underwriters to relax a few of the restrictions, ask for a bit less documentation. Mm. I mean, they've been told by the government, you know, with the Frank Dodd Act, to be very careful, and they're following those rules. They were actually following that sort of rule for the last 3 or 4 years. But in order to get more business, they need to start looking more optimistically at people's loans. And even if they've got some doubtful credit history, checking it out and being willing to actually advance money, because they can't make a profit unless they make more loans. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to gradually improve over the next 12 months or so. We're also going to see a lot of people who were in foreclosure and have been through that maybe 7 years ago now. 2008 was the first year we had a lot of foreclosures. Mm-hmm. They'll have got a chance to repair their credit and get back into home ownership. Next year is probably the first time we'll see a significant wave of those people coming through.
Mike Aware is director of the Center for Real Estate Theory and Practice at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. Mike, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
A lot of real estate agents, or those of us who are interested in what our homes or our neighbors' homes might be worth, surf over to Zillow or Trulia. Now the two companies are merging after reaching a $3.5 billion agreement. Joining me to talk about the merger and the reaction to it is Catherine Rieger, who covers real estate for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So based on the money I just mentioned for this merger, it sounds like looking at Zillow or Trulia online is a lot more than just like a guilty pleasure like it is for folks like me.
I think so. It is a very lucrative deal for Wall Street and for both those firms. You know, Zillow has doubled its market value in the past year. You know, we all skeptical sometimes on what that means, but it is a behemoth.
Well, how big a role have Zillow and Trulia played in the real estate market? How much has that affected realtors, and how much could this merger affect them going forward?
You know, they've had a big impact, and Zillow is, you know, kind of the gorilla in the room. They don't consider themselves a listing company. They consider themselves a media company. And, you know, Zestimates are a interesting way to look at your home values, and Mike Gore has talked about this in the past. Here in Metro Phoenix, we do have better thank you to Mike Warren Information Market. We have better real estate data. So sometimes these estimates are very off, and they upset real estate agents, and they upset homeowners. So, but definitely everyone's talking about them. And truly, you know, it's right behind them for being the biggest listing companies. So together, it's brought some issues. And I was in San Francisco at the Inman Real Estate Connect a couple weeks ago, and executives from both spoke, and there was no talk of the merger there, but there was talk of their growth, and you heard some boos and moans from the real estate agents in the audience. Yeah.
So coming back to how real estate agents feel about that, do sites like Zillow and Trulia give the average person more power? Does that make it more common for people to try to sell their own homes, thinking that they really know what it's worth?
I about selling their own homes. I mean, real estate agents definitely, even if they don't like Zillow or Trulia, they advertise on it. But they, there's complaints about the advertising because you can pay more and get your name on that neighborhood even if you don't specialize in it. So those are issues. And, of course, real estate agents have their own MLS. They own that. It's a member-oriented, and it has the best information out there. And, you know, it's not public like a Trulia is or a Zillow. So when homeowners or home buyers or shoppers look at Trulia and Zillow and then contact the real estate agent, the information they have is incorrect, they're, you know, it's a frustrating time. So it's kind of a love-hate relationship.
Okay. So MLS, multiple listing services, is there concern in the real estate business that Zillow might move toward that?
That's interesting because at this Real Estate Connect, I think CFO of Zillow was asked that question. Mm-hmm. He said, no, we don't want to get in the MLS business. But they are starting this new thing where it's basically listings to come, and a lot of the brokerages have their own listings, and they're going to debut that, so it's more of a competition and takes on more of that. But again, either one of these, neither Zillow or Trulia has all the listings in the market or as many as an MLS has. So there is that frustration. And as real estate agents, strive to compete like we all do, they want to present the best information out there. And, you know, just recently there's already talk about antitrust issues with the Zillow Trulia deal. And you think, well, they're marketing companies, but really Zillow calls itself a media company. So I don't know if this is going to go very smoothly or possibly might not even happen, or is what some analysts are saying.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask you as a final question, as a takeaway, what do you see as the ultimate fallout from this if it goes forward?
I put out the question to real estate agents and, looked at what the analyst said because, Zillow being public, they're saying more expensive advertising rates for real estate agents, not necessarily better information. So possibly not a great result, but at the same time, there are all these startups coming to the market to get into this. Real estate has gone technology, and most agents want to get the best information out there and the best way they can. And so there could be more competition from some of these smaller firms and potentially from, the MLSs getting into the business as well.
Hmm. Catherine Rieger covers real estate for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Check out her column. You can follow her on Twitter at Catherine Rieger. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about dark money and whether it's getting a bad rap. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Santee, whose business is to grow your business with digital, mobile, TV, radio, and PR to reach consumers where they live, work, and play. You can find out more at Santee.com, Santy.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. You can find us online at KJZZ.org. Look for sunny skies and a high of 107 in the valley today. Overnight, it'll be clear with a low in the upper 70s. Tomorrow, sunny and 105. Friday, mostly to partly sunny and a high of 104 degrees. At 12 this afternoon, we'll have NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Russian hackers have stolen about 1.2 billion online passwords, and the international community is joining forces to fight the Ebola outbreak in Africa. That's coming up on Here and Now from Boston today at noon. Sunny skies and 99 degrees right now in Phoenix. It's 11:41 at KJZZ.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The term dark money has been used a lot lately, especially during the current election season. How many individuals and organizations are giving money to certain candidates, causes, or independent expenditure groups to help determine who wins certain offices? And should the public know who's behind those contributions? Glenn Hammer, president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, wrote about that in the Arizona Republic, and he's with me now. Glenn, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So, Glenn, you don't like the term dark money. What does that imply to you?
Well, chambers have feelings, too. The implication is that there's something sinister going on. And, in terms of what we've been engaged in through the Arizona Business Coalition, and the Arizona Republic wrote an editorial that mentioned the Arizona Business Coalition today and mentioned that its members are the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, and Greater Phoenix Leadership. We believe what we're doing is in the light of day and is in the public's good.
Glenn, there are some I think who might. I'm going to use the term red herring. They might think that your defense of that makes sense. They might say, okay, these business organizations are out in front, but there are a lot of other groups who aren't. So is there a feeling that, okay, maybe you're not playing in dark money, but there are others who are, and by defending your group, you're defending those groups as well?
Well, Steve, I always like when campaign speech is used in a way that benefits the candidates that we have endorsed. With that said, I do believe that there is a positive overall when there are more resources devoted to the discussion of political issues. Not all of it's enlightening. Some of it is enraging. But, you know, for a country that still, I believe, spends more money on Easter candy advertisements than political speech, overall, I view the Citizens United case and the ability for entities to engage in the political process as a positive.
But Glenn, can you see where some critics are coming from this standpoint? If a group or individual is allowed to support whomever they want, and obviously in this country that is, we hope that is always the case, why shouldn't the public know about who they're supporting?
Well, it's certainly one data point, and I believe that the speech is more effective personally when there is credible entities behind it. Again, getting back to the Arizona Business Coalition, where just for the record, Steve, we spend the significant majority of our efforts on educational outreach type activities. We've worked on different issues on healthcare, education, on immigration. But I think speech does have more pop where there's the closer to the tie to the candidate personally, I believe the more effective the speech is. But I also believe that there are certain situations where it may not be something that certain entities want to do. I mean, look, we've all read about the different things going on with the IRS. I'd be a little bit, there's a reason why people are sometimes nervous when they enter this space.
Glenn, what do you think would be lost then if some groups are not able to remain anonymous? Where limits are not in effect. People can spend and organizations can spend as much as they want, but again, that we know what's going on. Is there some sort of unfairness in that?
Steve, what disturbs me is that there's a lot of people out there, and I believe that their intentions are very good. I'm not disputing that, but the effect of what they're advocating on behalf of would mean less speech in the political space. And I know it's frustrating to turn on a television or to go on the internet and to see some of these messages, you know, some which are very negative and unpleasant. But I think given the scope of the problems that this country has, we will be better served with the more robust speech we could have in the political space. And again, I get upset when I watch some of it, particularly if it's against a candidate or an issue I believe in. But that's part of the game. And in terms of what we do, you know, chambers, and it's not just because of our chamber, the Greater Phoenix Chamber, but because of such great work that chambers across the country and the U.S. Chamber have been doing for years, we have a great brand. And when we stand behind a candidate and we get involved, we do so proudly and we do so in the light of day.
Glenn Hammer is president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. You could read his column at azcentral.com. Glenn, thank you as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Now with me is a critic of dark money. Chris Hurstam is a former legislative leader and was the chief of staff for then-Governor Fife Symington. Chris, you brought the issue of dark money to our attention quite a while ago, even before this current campaign season. What frustrates you in particular about what's going on with dark money?
Well, first of all, when Glenn said that the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, is overall a positive, I have to totally disagree with him. I think it's a huge negative. It occurred in January 2010, not that long ago. It was a 5-4 decision, and it it has allowed more corporate union and wealthy individuals their money to enter the political arena, especially I see that as a negative, because especially when there are no state laws that require them to divulge what's going on. Citizens United left the public only one way to really protect itself, and that is adequate, timely disclosure laws. Some states have them. Arizona does not. The Arizona legislature and this governor is not interested in passing such a law because it's benefiting mainly conservative Republicans right now, this dark money. But I just I have a huge problem with the dark money. I just believe in timely and full disclosure. And this if you look at the usage of the dark money and the ads that are running, they're horrible. I mean, they you know, you don't see positive, issue-oriented dark money. I want to say right now, though, that I agree with Glenn Hammer with regards to the Arizona Chamber, Phoenix Chamber, GPL, and their Arizona Business Coalition. In fact, the firm I work for belongs to the Arizona Chamber. That's not a problem, because if you see an ad you don't like or the media wants to find out why they're running something, they call up Glenn Hammer. They call up the chambers, and they'll defend themselves. But I'm talking about some of Glenn's buddies, like Sean Noble and Kirk Adams and the crew. They have a lot of different groups. We have a whole new era of political contribution secrecy. Political strategists create these nonprofit social welfare groups to escape disclosure requirements. There's huge IRS code loopholes and that allow these nonprofits to play in campaigns with secret cash. They have these names that convey selfless intentions, but their goal is to destroy political opponents and get their candidates chosen without the voters knowing who is funding the smear jobs. And this is crazy. This is really bad for our political system, and voters need to find out which candidates, particularly those that are running for Secretary of State and Governor, which candidates take a stand against dark money and will fight for disclosure laws in Arizona.
Chris, what about those who will say that, going back to the Founding Fathers, which is always the favorite phrase of some, that there was anonymity in some of that because of the pressure, and even what Glenn mentioned about the Tea Party groups being targeted?
Well, that's the Tea Party groups being targeted is horrible, and the IRS should be condemned for that. But that's a separate issue, frankly. This thing about the framers of our Constitution and during the Revolutionary War, they needed anonymous speech. Anonymous speech, by the way, is just an attempt to somehow make dark money sound better. That's ridiculous. This is 2014. We're 238 years later from declaring our independence in the Revolutionary War and so forth. You know, that's just a ruse in my view. The framers would be appalled by candidates today for state office engaging in a money chase for secret cash from people doing business with the governor. And we're not talking about anonymous leaflets or leaf letters that were used in a Revolutionary War. We're talking about today special interests who are seeking to influence government tax and regulatory policy totally out of sight of the public. It's time to raise the rock up, shine the sunlight on it. There's nothing wrong with full disclosure. Timely and full disclosure is something conservatives, liberals, Democrats, Republicans, and of course, independents, the largest group now, they should all strive for, and we need to elect candidates that are committed to fighting dark money.
If the clean election system, and forgive me, Tom Collins, had been more effective and had been something that people really had turned out voters really wanted it to be, would that have dampened the possibility of something like dark money?
Yes. I think if the matching funds that the court struck down, they've somewhat neutered clean elections. And you know, if you had a vibrant public financing system with more money in it and so forth, yes, I think it would counter it. You know, I got to say one more thing.
Sure.
In Glenn's op-ed piece in The Republic, he takes sort of a slap at what he calls the good government set. All I'll say is, you know, I've been around the Capitol for 32 years, and when political insiders start complaining about the good government set, watch out for your wallets. Make sure you even still have a wallet. I ask again, what is wrong with transparency? We don't live in China. The media and the public needs to know who is giving the money to these dark money campaigns, and at least hold those people and the candidates they're supporting responsible for it.
Chris, we've got about a minute left, and I want to come back to one of the things that Glenn said in his column as well. Whether this matters or not, perception does seem to have an effect on people. I mean, this is how we think and whatnot. Does the dark money term almost make it seem cartoonish? Would it be better if we actually had a term that, because it can be spun in such a way that, oh, dark money, woo, 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 we should be scared of that, as opposed to really what it is? Or do you think dark money is an effective term to tell people what's going on?
I think you can call it secret cash. You can call it dark money. It's money that is going into political campaigns without being reported. Mm-hmm. And that it's we need tough disclosure laws in Arizona, like they have in other states, that will allow the average voter to find out who's paying for this junk that's on TV that in most cases smears candidates. It's just that simple. So I don't see nothing wrong with dark money or secret cash. To me, it explains what the problem is.
Former state legislative leader Chris Hurstam. Chris, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. To put it mildly, 2014 has been a rough season for the Arizona Diamondbacks. The bad run started just before the team was ready to board a flight to Australia, where the season began against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Ace starting pitcher Patrick Corbin had injured his elbow and wouldn't take the mound at all this year. Arizona has had one of the worst records in the majors for most of the season, and the organization has taken a lot of flack for how it handles certain on-field situations, like when its pitchers should throw at opposing batters.
2-0. And there it is. McCutchen hit, and Delgado run from the game. There were pregame warnings issued, and McCutchen is struck in the ninth inning. 95-mile-an-hour fastball right in the middle of the back.
You know, there's a big difference between pitching inside to get outs and trying to hit somebody with a fastball. Big difference.
Over the weekend, Diamondbacks pitcher Randall Delgado hit Pittsburgh Pirates star Andrew McCutchen one night after Diamondbacks all-star Paul Goldschmidt was hit on the hand with a fastball, which has knocked Goldschmidt out for the balance of the season. Many critics are saying the Diamondbacks have taken old-school baseball too far, to the extent that it's actually hurting the team and how it's seen throughout the rest of baseball. Grantland contributor Michael Bauman hit the Diamondbacks hard with his recent piece, The Diamondbacks' Disgrace.
I have no gripe with the Diamondbacks or as an organization or their fans. You know, I've got no stock in whether they win or lose, but a lot of stuff that Kirk Gibson's done since becoming manager and Kevin Towers is GM in terms of kind of being really uptight and attempting to take a lot of the fun out of baseball, which, you know, for all the money that's involved and as seriously as we take it, it's a game, it's entertainment. They've got sort of a long track record of really trying to ruin everybody else's fun whenever, you know, a player like Yasiel Puig, for instance, shows emotion. But what really got me upset about what happened over the weekend is that, you know, Andrew McCutchen is good for baseball. And if you're going to throw a ball at 90-odd miles an hour at him, there's a decent chance that he could get hurt. And if Andrew McCutchen's on the disabled list, that means that, you know, fans across the country, across the world, can't watch him for as long as he's gone, essentially just because the Diamondbacks manager and GM got their feelings hurt over something that happened accidentally. And I think that's just a gross overreaction. It's really fake machismo that I really think that we're too evolved as a society to tolerate in sports anymore.
One of the things that's interesting living here is the fans and even some of the media here who've been disappointed in Kirk Gibson. Gibson as a player was a guy who went all out, who was actually a football player in college, and he was just a guy who went crazy. I mean, he banged into walls, he played hurt all the time, and people were disappointed that he doesn't come out and yell at the umps after every call he doesn't like, that kind of, he doesn't seem to be a yeller and a screamer.
I can't really put myself in the mindset of fans like that. just because to me this is an instant, it just boils down to responding to being upset with violence. And Kirk Gibson ostensibly is the authority figure. He's the grown-up in the room. And I think if your manager is preaching that sort of thing, I think you ought to be above it, frankly.
I'm curious as to whether you think the Diamondbacks' approach from the management on down has impacted, or how much it has impacted, the team's play on the field. I mean, can a team have this kind of approach if they made better decisions as far as their personnel is concerned? Or are they jettisoning some of the personnel, some of their better players who maybe don't fit into this box they're describing?
I think the way you put it is right. There are two separate issues. There's the throwing at batters, there's the constantly being angry about anything that upsets a sort of a 1940s aesthetic of propriety. And you can get away with that if you're good enough. I mean, the Atlanta Braves last year were mad at pretty much everybody all the time, and they made the playoffs. The team that got me into baseball, the Phillies in 1993, they had a similar policy. If one of our hitters gets hit, then we're going to hit one of your hitters. And they won the pennant and came very close to winning the World Series because they had a great team. I think where this approach is getting in the way for Arizona is in the player personnel moves, trading away Justin Upton, who was on track to really be the best position player in franchise history. And they traded him because of reasons that are still not entirely clear to me. I think that Towers and Gibson and now Tony La Russa are getting involved in this sort of thing is not that surprising, because I think it's an outgrowth of a mentality that something other than skill and talent win games. The idea that you can win games by trying harder or being somehow morally superior. The truth is everybody's extremely talented. You don't get to the big leagues unless you're talented and you try hard. They've hamstrung themselves by trading away talented players, Upton, Chris Young, Trevor Bauer, who don't mesh for whatever reason with the personality they want the team to take, which, it's, again, if they want to have that personality, that's fine. But the players they've chosen to express it have gotten them quite a bit out of the playoff race.
So in your opinion, even with Tony La Russa having taken over baseball operations, is general manager Kevin Towers in trouble? Is manager Kirk Gibson in trouble? Do you think the Diamondbacks will try to take a different approach?
They built a team a couple of years ago that won the division and was very close to making the World Series. And then they systematically dismantled it. So I don't know what's going on, how tired ownership is of losing. And I don't know. LaRusse's position is not unique. I think he's sort of a big picture overseer type. They just want someone with his kind of baseball experience in there to advise ownership and advise management. So I don't know what his plans are. I don't know what ownership's plan is.